Recovering You, a discussion of addiction, childhood trauma, and strategies to recover your sanity and health in the age of opioid epidemic. With co-host John Case, Drs. Leslie Beth Wish and Zaki McGill. This podcast of the Are You Crazy Health and Wellness Wednesday program was broadcast on May 31st, 2017 on Enlighten Radio. Find out more information at enlightenradio.org.
Write things you can say.
All right, let's do our station ID here to get started officially, because the podcast, I just started it, actually.
Okay.
This is the Are You Crazy Health and Wellness Wednesday program, Dr. Zaki McGill and myself, John Case, and we have as our special guest and one whom we dearly love. I've never met you except on the phone. I feel like I know you pretty well. Dr. Leslie Beth Wish, her website is lovevictory.com, and the conversations about, you know, relationships and all different aspects of human relationships. We've covered so many of them here. She's on the with us again this morning, and we always enjoy having her here. And Dr. McGill, what do we want to talk about today?
Well, first off, I wanted to tell Dr. Wish that that there was an expose that was just published in the New Yorker about my specific town, Martinsburg, West Virginia, and the county, Berkeley County. Although the article certainly covers, talks about this whole area, and it's entitled The Addict Next Door. And it's about our epidemic of heroin addiction that is killing people at the rate of 2 to 3 a week. You know, the ENTs are inundated with multiple overdose calls every day. And so I encourage our listeners, you know, to check it out online. The New Yorker, it's the reporter who I actually got to meet through Dr. John Aldis, a heroin addiction practitioner, is Margaret Talbot with The New Yorker. And boy, you can tell she put a lot of energy and heart into this article.
This is their headline article for the month, for this week, anyway, actually, The New Yorker. It's having a big impact. You know, I posted it, and I think I've gotten 70 shares.
Wow.
I don't use. I mean, okay. That's for me. I don't spend that much time. That's unusual, right? Okay, so
right.
And I thought that was really, it's very profound. It's interesting, Dr. Wish, that it's a lot of different people that she interviewed, and but one of the interesting was is that this culture of not much hope, not much opportunity, nothing ever changes or gets better. I thought I wanted to live in the community I grew up in, but I really can't afford to. And I don't know where to go. All the, you know, things we've all heard before, but just a cultural depression or negativity that is just pervasive. And the researchers found that was in itself, maybe it was a consequence of the addiction epidemic, but it certainly also was now a contributing cause of its expansion. And I'm sure you have a lot of experience with this kind of thing too down there. I'm sure, I mean, the number of people that are now addicted and looking like they're living in an ordinary home and not, asleep on a street corner is just astonishing. So what's your experience with this and your thoughts?
Well, I have not read the article, but I've read other articles that mention West Virginia in general and some of the towns. And it's very sad. And you raise the issue of cause and effect, what causes it. It's circular, and it feeds on itself. So where do you start? It doesn't matter where you start. Are you prone to depression? Are you prone to addiction? Did you just lose your job? Are there no jobs in your community? Did you just get divorced? I mean, there's no beginning point. And I think that's probably pretty true of life in general. And so when a town doesn't offer good jobs, doesn't offer education that people can afford, or people can't afford it for other reasons because they're spending their money somewhere else, or they've got child support. I mean, there's so many reasons.
Yeah.
any place that you intervene on that circle is going to help. There is no one solution. There are many solutions, and you need so many people and organizations in a community rowing together. And that's one of the really hard parts. Secondly, is the problem of the shift in what kinds of skills now and in the future are going to be required to hold a job that is more than paycheck to paycheck. We're moving rapidly, even faster than we thought, towards a technology culture. People need to develop those skills, but what about those skills that can't be done by a computer? Like fixing your car, like a plumber, an electrician, gardeners. There's so many positions that will always, well, I can't say always, but pretty much be there.
Yeah.
So those are the kinds of things that people need. When I worked a lot with veterans, PTSD, injury, that was their problem. They didn't know how to refocus what their skills were or learn new ones. And that is a key thing that every community needs to do when they have not only the population of addicts, but just in general.
Right, exactly. What this article exposed, Dr. Wish, is you know, this debate between many people in the community about what's the one right way. You know, John Aldis, who we've had on this program many times, who actually treats addicts with medication-assisted treatment, you know, talks about how, well, he's talked on the show and he talks on the in the article about how, you know, he's gotten such huge pushback from people who say, no, 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 you cannot use Suboxone, you cannot use these drugs that, you know, in their mind, replace one addictive drug with another addictive drug, not understanding the science of it and the record of it and the research to show that, you know, some people need, you know, something like a medication to transition. You know, I've had, you know, the article cites another gentleman who have in who's like the county commissioner for trying to do something about all this. And, you know, he's, you know, he makes no secret of the fact that he's a recovering person. And, you know, he started out, you know, a year or two ago when I got he and John Aldis together for a conversation, you know, believing that medication should never be offered to a recovering addict, that all they needed was the 12-step program. So you have these camps around, you know, medication, no medication, do this, do that, as opposed to your holistic approach of, you know, whatever works is what works. And you have to try different things for different people, and no one size fits all.
100% I agree. And I know from probably treating probably 12,000 people in my life, and some of them were addicts. You know, why, think about this. Why are there so many prescription and non-prescription drugs on the market to treat the same or similar symptoms? Because one pill doesn't work in a category for every single person. Nor does one kind of modality of treating, you know, doing therapy. You know, I remember in my training, and you might remember this too, Dr. Zaki, is for the longest time there was only psychoanalytic counseling. Well, you know, maybe for some people that works and others it doesn't, but it's really important to get into lots of ways of helping people. So it's really a destructive battle to have this competition as to what's the right way. It really depends on the person, and you really need to have someone or a team look at the person. What are they allergic to? What's worked in the past? What hasn't worked? What are their skills? What's their life plan? It needs to be more than just in a MD's office. It needs to be in a whole team's office of offering all these factors that go into that circle.
Absolutely. You know, that's a brilliant point you make. You know, you look at cardiovascular disease, and you probably have 24 different kinds of drugs, you know, prescription drugs to choose from. you know, depending upon a person's genetic makeup, the sex, the gender, you know, all kinds of factors that feed into whether they're an adult or a child, all kinds of factors that feed into whether a particular medication is going to work for them or their condition or not. The same with diabetes. So your point is well taken. Unfortunately, you know, if we look at addiction, like heroin addiction, we really only have a couple different choices. You know, there has not been that, I guess there's not been that much research and interest and enterprise put into developing, you know, more forms of medication-assisted treatment. But maybe we're on the brink where, you know, that will change. One thing that Dr. Aldiss gets pushed up against all the time is that some people, you know, with really serious addiction, chronic addiction, may need higher doses of the medications to transition them from heroin or, you know, very strong painkillers like fentanyl to abstinence. And so you have a lot of practitioners in the area who underprescribe these medications, and therefore the clients don't come back. You know, it fails. You know, they can't stay clean, can't stay abstain from the heroin. So they you know, they relapse and they give up, and they resume their, you know, addictive lifestyle. And what Dr. Aldiss has railed against with me in utter frustration all the time is that if you offer them adequate dosages, you know, they will respond to them, but you've got to keep pushing it until they respond. You know, I gave the analogy to, you know, Kevin Knowles, the county commissioner for this. I said, Kevin, this is like someone has a migraine headache and you're saying, well, all I'm going to give them is an aspirin. You know, you know, they need more. Or someone that has a very severe, you know, when I get a headache, you know, bad headache, you know, it's two or three ibuprofen, not just one. But this idea, almost like a homeopathic approach that some practitioners in the area want to take, that, well, this is a very strong, this Suboxone is such a strong medication, and it can be addicting, that I'm only going to give a certain amount of it. And therein you have a lot of treatment failures that's just very demoralizing to the community and to practitioners like John Aldiss who see that there's, you know, there's another way to approach this.
I agree. You know, when a person goes to their physician for whatever other medication or a problem, that person or the nurse practitioner, whoever sees you in the office, sees this little tiny slit of you, okay? Mm-hmm. They don't know your whole life. They don't have time, and that's not how many of them, not all, but how many of them are trained. You're there. You've got this problem. It's a narrow little ray of light. And that was the efficacy a long time ago of the country doctor, the town doctor, mm-hmm. who knew you, who saw you in whatever religious service you went to, or at the post office, or walking down the street, or at the 4th of July. And it was not a bad thing to call the doc and say, hey, doc, so-and-so is on a bender again, or so-and-so hasn't gotten out of their house or dressed in 3 days. Happened. I mean, sure. Really, you know, that's how a community knew each other. And so we don't have that as much anymore. There are some places, yes, but not as much. So what you have to do is recreate a community team. So they're all working together. Someone who knows the medical history, the family history, the psychological history, the allergy history, the family life history, divorce, children, so that you know the whole person and there isn't anyone afraid to overprescribe for fear of getting sued, because that is in so many practitioners' sure. minds these days. But that's not being done. It's expensive. It takes a lot of time. So you hope that there'll be some little space in a community where the charitable organizations and the community organizations get together to offer something like that and make it clear that this is where you can come to get a more comprehensive help.
Absolutely. You know, you remind me of early on in my practice as a young practitioner, you know, getting humbled by the fact that, you know, I might sit with a patient for an hour, hour and a half for initial evaluation and think I had done a really thorough job. But I came to understand that I was just getting a snapshot, that, you know, some patients weren't aware of certain aspects of their disorder or their difficulty, or weren't revealing certain aspects. And I used to liken it. I said, you know, I'm just getting, nurses used to turn to me and say, well, what do you think? And I said, you know what? I just have a snapshot. I need a photo, a family album to look at. And when clients would come to me and were very resistant to, you know, allowing me to speak to spouses, to family members, to parents, you know, to get a broader picture of their employer, to get a broader picture of what was actually going on with them, you know, I came to believe that, you know what, there wasn't a whole lot I might do for this person. Especially talking about, you know, chronic mental illness, where sometimes clients could come to the office and sort of hold it together for me for an hour and not seem psychotic. And then later I would hear from family members that they were, you know, in essence, howling at the moon when they got home at night, or at different points in time, you know, floridly hallucinating and doing all sorts of bizarre things, which completely...
Well, you're talking about trusting what you think you're seeing, and you
right.
can't.
Yes.
You can't. You know, that's why... And just think of all the litigation that goes on, all the HIPAA forms you have to fill out, and you've got to get permission from this person and that person. Okay, but it's still possible to do that, to get both a community and a family view.
Mm-hmm.
Very important. So you get not a 100% accurate picture, because families could come in with an agenda. Hey, we got to put
True.
Grandma away or Uncle Bob away, okay? But, you know, you begin to see the whole family. You get to read their faces, their body language. There's nothing more powerful than being there with them, so you can get all the contradictory or confirming cues and clues. Very, very important. And I remember something in my post-grad training, because my post-grad training is in family and marriage, family systems. And I did that for 3 years at Georgetown, not 3 months. And one of the things that the director of the program, who's no longer alive, his name is Dr. Murray Bowen, said, just
be aware. Oh, wait a minute. The famous Bowen?
Yes, that's who trained me.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yes, that's who trained me.
Okay.
A lot of people don't know who he is, but I thought I'd mention his name. Yes, I went. He was at Georgetown Medical School, and he started this post-grad training, and I was there for 3 years. And it was just, it changed my life personally and professionally, but that's besides the point. Listeners don't need to hear that. But so some of the things he said to us was, assume that when someone comes to your office, they're hurting and they want to get better, but they're afraid to get better because of what they fear it might take.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing
True.
He said was, you need to assume that many of your clients are withholding important information.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Sometimes presenting directly false information.
And false information. Well, he said, I mean, in a harsher tone, he said clients lie often, and it's very hard to get a whole picture. So what can you do to find out, for the practitioners and nurses and physicians and the religious people and, you know, other community people, how do you know that someone has a problem but is really good, as you said, at keeping it together for a short amount of time, but going home and doing drugs or harming someone or whatever you don't know about?
Mm-hmm.
And there are some ways to kind of get a little peephole into that, but none of them are guaranteed. So I think all the practitioners who have contact community-wise and professionally, all of them need to be educated as to, when do I speak up if I suspect something? Will I get sued if I do? You know, all those things need to be talked about. What kinds of questions should a physician or a medical practitioner or a therapist ask? And some of the things are, gee, we've been talking for 20 minutes and I get the sense that this is uncomfortable for you. And I want you to know that there's no shame here. There's no finger pointing. So let's pretend that there's only 10 minutes left in our time for our appointment together. Mm. What do I need to know so you can get your time and money's worth?
There you go.
And it's surprising how many people say, well, the real reason I'm here is that I've been cheating on my husband, you know, and then you begin to get to the core. But and there's all that's just one of many techniques to use to let people feel comfortable, to let people be able to access help that doesn't frighten them. You have to normalize the anxiety. Look, you get a gold star for coming here, but don't think that the rest of it is downhill. This is just the beginning, and I'm here to help you with the desire to bolt out of this office and never come back. So you need to hit those issues right away. And you need to find out, see, we're not communities anymore. You know, back in those wonderful Doris Day movies with Gordon McRae singing in a boat or whatever, these were communities. These were people knew that, you know, Aunt Charlotte was getting tipsy again, you know. So how do you reproduce that? And that's why I think having a really strong team is so important.
Absolutely, yeah. No, I know of Dr. Bowen because my family therapy supervisor, I want to give her a shout out. I don't even know if she's still alive. Kathleen Owens at the National Institute of Mental Health just blew me away as a supervisor in showing me how, you know, the dynamics of a family therapy session and, you know, how much information you gain from having families come in and talk with you and how, and the dynamic that sometimes the identified patient is not the real patient in the family, that you have the ambassador, you have the kid who acts out, becomes sick or is very depressed or psychotic, who's trying to bring attention to a parent who's really suffering. And, you know, that was just so enlightening. And, you know, so I carry that into my practice that, yeah, I don't really know what's going on with this client. Until, you know, I've been with them a long time, if it's individual and I'm not going to see anyone else, you know, I basically don't think I really know the real problem until I've been seeing them at least 3 months or more. With a family, it can often, you know, be sooner. If they're willing, then there's probably less shame around whatever they're suffering with. But that the issue of shame is, you know, when a client comes to you and they're so ashamed, first of all, that they have to come see you. You know, I've had clients who have admitted that they've parked, you know, half a mile away so no one would ever associate their car with the building that they were coming into to see me. And then if we talk about a drug addiction, you know, there's so much shame that revolves around that, that when you work in, you know, in treating addicts, you become very skeptical. You know, it's like the rule of thumb. If you ask an addict, well, how much have you used today? And they tell you one thing, you double it or triple it.
Easily, that's right.
You know, because you know you're not going to get the whole picture. And then, of course, there are the issues of having been sexually abused, how long it might take someone to tell you in therapy that they've been sexually abused or molested, or that they had parents that were just, sadistic in their treatment of the child. There are all sorts of reasons why people are not going to reveal to a clinician, you know, early on, exactly what's going on with them.
And to reveal it to themselves, to say it out loud. My mother locked me in a closet for hours every day. You know, to say that out loud to keep it in your head is a totally different experience from saying it out loud. It makes it concrete. It makes it suddenly real. And you're so right. It's very difficult. And that's why it's so important to let people you know who you are helping, whatever your profession is that there's no shame. I mean, there's no point in getting lost in shame because that's a fake feeling. It's not a helpful feeling. What shame does is that it keeps you in a mode of believing you're worthless, not good, you failed. And that is a cop-out, because then it means you're off the hook for taking any responsibility for yourself because you're a failure, you're bad, you're no good, you're not lovable. And so you walk around with that as a coat of armor and with your shield and swords and everything, and your chain mail and a moat around you, because you don't want to hear that shame is, and blaming yourself, one of the ways of keeping yourself down. You perpetuate the bad feelings because it's too hard to fix things. So you need to let people know how brave they are to come to you, see you and seek help, but it's going to be a rough road. It's not going to be easy. They may not even feel good when they leave your office. They might feel worse. And that's why you need, more people in the self-help community to be there with eyes on this person and to develop a treatment plan and to find a way quickly in the first time a person comes to see you what their resistance will be about. What will be your excuses? And that's what I ask a lot of people. Let's pretend that you're really anxious in talking to me and you really can't wait for this time to be over and you keep looking at your watch. What are some of the thoughts going through your head that make you think you're not ever coming back? Let's address those. Because if you don't hit that head on, you're just crossing your fingers and hoping that they come back or go see someone else.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. It's, but, it's how many times have I had patients who, the shame is based on this the false notion that because they had a parent who abused them, that says something about them, that they they deserved it, or they were unworthy of love and care and appropriate parenting. To admit that you had a parent that did that to you, it's just an overwhelming obstacle.
Why is that? Is that because the relationship between the therapist and the patient is really not that trustful to be able to say something like that? Or what's the fear of that? If I say that, if I admit to you, blah, blah, that somehow, somewhere you'll tell somebody and I won't be able to tolerate that.
No, I don't think
so. Is that
so.
It?
No, that's a good question. Let's look at it this way. The number one fear of human beings is abandonment, being tossed to the world and there's no one there as your emotional or physical safety net, that you're just going to be abandoned. And there are lots of ways of being abandoned. You can be literally abandoned, left on the doorstep of a church or whatever, or emotionally abandoned and emotionally disrespected. So what happens in families that are abusive physically and sexually is that, especially sexually, because that is inside your body. Usually, I'm not saying that one is less awful than another, but it's like finally the physical abuse has gotten inside you, like your barrier has really been penetrated, literally and figuratively. And so what happens is, no one wants in the family, the person who's abused wants to talk about it, because what are the consequences? The consequence is that it will probably break up the family. Someone's going to jail. Someone's, getting incarcerated.
Right.
Someone's being taken out of the home. Somehow the home is going to be changed. And what happens, and not consciously either, it's the hell I know now is going to be better than being put in foster care, a dad not home, mom not home, being poorer than we are now, and I have to keep this family together. It'll be my fault if it falls apart. And all of that goes to the unconscious, ill-expressed, barely known fear of abandonment. This is really going to threaten the family. In a very interesting study that a researcher named Teresa Russell did on women who came to emergency rooms with injuries, and they found out in the emergency room that a high percentage of these girls were also sexually abused because of damage to their genitals. And when they were told that, they denied it. No, that couldn't be. That just couldn't be. So here was literally physical proof, okay, that something had happened. Some of them even came in and were pregnant, you know, 13-year-old girls. And here they were being told, and they still couldn't believe it. So that's how strong the fear of looking at your caregivers and know that they were caretakers, they took from you, and that your knowledge of this is now putting your family in jeopardy. And what goes through your mind or just your emotions are, what's going to happen to me? What's going to happen to them? Who am I going to live with? Who's going to take care of me? That's how powerful the fear of being abandoned and raised by people who really don't love you is.
In perfect sense, yeah.
No, that makes sense. I wonder sometimes though if you get involved, the enablers, there's usually we have the victim and we have the person who committed some sort of crime or abuse, but then there's other enablers in the family a lot of times, right? That either cover it up or don't say, or keep it a secret. Siblings or the spouse, or I mean, right? The grandmother living in the house, I don't know, it could be anybody, right? They probably, I mean, especially if, let's suppose the abuser is bringing in the money and the rest of them are dependent upon him. Okay, hey, that,
correct.
Right there,
you can see how dangerous that could be.
Sure.
And here in Teresa Russell's research, there was proof positive, and so this is what happens. I've worked with so many survivors of childhood sexual abuse, and they say, even after there's been proof positive, and even there might be one person in the family that says, I knew about it, I saw it, it happened to me. You know, there's always someone somewhere. It's still not believed. It's a terrible thought to think that your parents or your caregivers could do this to you.
Right.
And don't forget, we're a highly sexualized culture now. I've heard people on television and read in articles written by, experts in the field say that there are people who say, what's the big deal? It's just sex.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
What's so bad about it? You know, get a life. You know, it's over, you know.
Yeah, just right.
Well, Dr. Wish, do you think child sexual abuse is more prevalent in our culture than in other cultures? I mean, do you have any sense of this?
That's a really good question.
It came to mind because you said our culture is so sexualized. Now, we as Americans, I grew up thinking that the French, you know, the French are always put up as the people that are so sexual. Yet what I learned was that the French are, they have this dichotomy. They really frown strongly on premarital sex. They're very strict about that. But after you're married, then the idea of having a mistress or a mister, you know, is
more acceptable.
More acceptable.
I see.
You know, it's not seen as something as horrible, as traumatic, as devastating to a marriage as it is here. So I'm just, you know, I that came to mind. So I that's why my question is, do you think child sex, because, you know, Margaret Mead, even had some anthropological, writings about certain cultures, I think in the South Pacific, where, sex between, a father and a daughter was his job to introduce his daughter to sex. And when that was questioned, when they were confronted about that, their reaction was, well, you know, who to be more gentle or considerate or loving to a daughter than a father? Now, in our minds, this is outrageous. You know, it just it causes us to feel queasy, nauseous at the idea. But in their mind, it was very different. And I'm thinking that perhaps, you know, because that was part of their culture and connoted, framed as a positive, it does not have the traumatic effects that it does in our culture, where it's this deep, dark secret, where people are doing it in secrecy, and you know, it's absolutely forced upon the child, and often done by not the parents but some other family member or a boyfriend of the mother and so forth. Any thoughts?
That's a really good point. Yes, culture will often intervene, and there are stories that Margaret Mead talks about where all the young adolescent virgin girls, they all went to a community hut and they were all deflowered, you know, mm-hmm. and that was part of the tradition, and that does intercede. It does have an effect on getting the message across. So it really depends on your culture, but we don't live in primitive cultures anymore, and every yeah. culture has different views of virginity and fidelity and what it does. But we certainly know that non-consensual sex, particularly with minors, is essentially most of the time not a very good idea. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, I remember when Bessel van der Kolk, who is a specialist in this, very well known and respected, talked about how he was locked in a basement and how there was physical and all kinds of different abuse, and no one believed him. No one could even think that anybody would do that. And what's interesting is so many pillars of the community, the Boy Scout leader, the athletic coach, the Girl Scout leader, the head of the bank, you know, it's not believed. It still isn't believed. I mean, shows like Dateline and 48 Hours are filled with, you know, pillars of the community who've done terrible things. So it's still in our culture that somehow the secret can be kept, and maybe it's not so bad. And a lot of my clients have never even told their best friends because it's too unbelievable what's happened in their family. And they also don't want to be labeled and have everything about them being seen as, oh, well, that's just the way Patty is because she was, you know, abused. Yeah. And who would want that label?
Sure, sure, yeah. Especially true of men who were sexually abused. Tell it much less frequently than women. But you touched on another point, the secrecy, the denial. I've seen qualitatively different outcomes in patients who've come to me who are sexually abused, and yeah, everyone denies it, you know. So it's them against the whole family, as opposed to I've had clients who they approached their mother and immediately she took action.
I know people that have put a stop to it, you know, right here in Shepherdstown that both of those experiences have happened to, you know.
Yeah.
So but that's a question that you know, the denial thing, that's very destructive too. Like if the family does deny it and it happened, that's its own form of abandonment right there.
Absolutely. You know? Yeah.
Yes. Where do you go?
That's
for
the
ultimate comfort,
right? Know? The ultimate form of abandonment, I would say, to deny a person's reality. I'm stepping back a moment and looking at how we segued from addiction into sexual abuse, and it's reminding me of our friend Larry Bish, who's a counselor at the local jail, who has been on the show several times. And Larry will say, there's like 500 people at the jail, Dr. Wish.
Right.
You know, and it's about maybe three counselors. So Larry has resorted to doing group sort of psychoeducational modules because he doesn't have time to see everybody. But, you know, Larry says that to an inmate, that there was always childhood trauma. and often sexual and almost always physical, severe physical abuse. And that he firmly believes as a counselor, as a therapist, that unless you address those, these guys will never, you know, get well, be productive. They will always be carrying, you know, those demons.
Some terrible load of guilt and,
yeah,
or hatred.
Self-hatred.
Rage.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Hatred and self-hatred.
What you're saying is pretty true across the board of the American prison population. A very high percentage of them have been sexually and or physically abused. And one of the inmates who's hated the most is the one who has abused a child. Boy, you come in there, and everybody, you know, the word goes out that this is a child rapist. You're
in trouble.
Forget it. Your life is going to be really, really miserable in that prison. So there's great truth to that, and it's unfortunate. And I think also that the idea of letting someone know about it, particularly your mother or the non-abusing parent, in Judith Herman's book, Father-Daughter Incest, she talks a lot about how much anger there is at the mother for not protecting the child.
Oh, yeah,
up, not opening her eyes. And that as much hate and animosity and anger there is at the perpetrator, it's a totally different type of anger at the mother. That's your last place to not feel abandoned, and then you find out that she's collapsed on you, too.
Yeah. Absolutely.
That's got to be devastating. And well, we know people that's happened to, and it is devastating. I'm not sure. It's a difficult thing to recover from, and you have to somehow construct alternate communities of some sort to get connected, right? I mean, there are, you know, opportunities for that in a lot of communities, but still, it's you're like damaged goods. And a lot of times the group efforts, you know, you join some group, you go on to some meditation retreat, or you do this, you do that. I mean, it helps for a while, but it's not maybe a sustainable, can't do it every week, can't do it every month, you know, hard.
Yeah, you know, when I was in Florida practicing, I worked with a group therapist. I used to refer a lot of patients to his group therapies, and he really relied on a model of after people, you know, obtain a certain amount of health, to start adopting family of choice. When they had a really toxic family, to start looking and developing relationships with healthy people, healthier people. That and so that became a common nomenclature: family of origin, family of choice. And I can remember many clients coming back and saying, yeah, well, you know, my family of origin is totally toxic. I probably will never have a relationship with them, but I have control over who I allow into my life now, and my choices for family are going to be healthier ones. Thoughts, Dr. Wish?
That's excellent, excellent, because that's what you need to do. And I it's so important that you surround yourself. And you, here's another aspect to this. You know, the talk shows on TV and People magazine and all these other magazines that, you know, tell all and all these, you know, shows where there's a gift. You know, you do not owe anyone your life history. You do not owe that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've had people come up to me. I could not have children. And I've had people come up to me and say, strangers, like when you, you know, like at intermission at the symphony or something. Mm-hmm. Oh, hi, how are you? And it's just astounding what comes out of people's mouths.
Yeah.
So I'll be standing there with my husband, and they'll say, so do you have any children? You know, how many children do you have? Only one? You know, so, I mean, I don't even tell them that I raised my stepdaughter, because she literally lived with my husband and me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm very grateful that I've had a chance to be a parent, because I really wanted that experience. I wanted that. I love parenting. I still do. You're always parenting. And
oh, that's by the way, has your daughter left the house yet?
Yes, she has.
He has. Yeah. Okay, so how, you know, now sometimes they come right back. Okay, just so you know.
No, She's a prosecuting attorney, and she's married to an Whoa. Attorney. They live about 2 hours.
There you go.
Boy, she's got a spine of steel.
There you go. That's
she
right.
She does. She's
well,
funky.
He probably has a letter. Is her husband the prosecutor, or is she the prosecutor?
No. He works for a private firm. He does divorce work.
Oh, she's the prosecutor.
She's a prosecutor.
Oh, right. Yeah. All right. So she would be keen on any evidence.
Oh, absolutely. She's good. We knew she was going to be an attorney when she was 8 years old. Her favorite book was called It's Not Fair.
There you go.
But the point I'm making is that, you know, you do not owe an answer to people when they say, you know, how many kids you have. You didn't have any of your own. You don't owe people your life story. I've had people come up to my husband and ask him, is this your first marriage? And my husband's answer, which I think is brilliant, is this is our first marriage. This is our own marriage.
This is our first marriage. Yeah, right.
This is the real one. You know, that's what he said. That's great.
Yeah,
I think that's a great, and that just spontaneously came out of my mind. Because you do not owe anybody your life story. And I think one of the things that happens to survivors of abuse is that they feel if they don't tell every person who they meet in their life, their story, that they don't feel known.
Right.
And that's what this tell-all culture has produced. No, just think about it. You don't tell your best friends every single thing about you. Hold back. Take charge. And the core of that is being able to develop a sense of saying to yourself, I am lovable. I am worthwhile. I'm a good person, and I don't need to trump out all my other stuff about me in order to test whether this person really could like me.
However, we live in a very, very, very socialized, in the small s, I'll say, kind of society, right? In which, you know, like, well, we live in a small town here in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. Let me tell you that if you do something, everybody in town will figure it out if you've been around a little while. I mean, it's everyone's in your business all the time. And then it gets extreme occasionally. I mean, I had a friend that some time ago, you know, lost her partner. And, man, for like 4 or 5 months, you know, it was all over the social media, you know, really. I mean, every difficult moment, okay? You know, somebody looking for a way to, you know, connect, get out of it. It's true.
You do see some excessively personal revelations on people's posts on Facebook.
Yeah. Well, and probably some other social media too. I mean, yeah, it's just something that people feel like they don't have enough outlet amongst their friends, and they feel they gotta, you know, stand on the street corner and get the bullhorn and say, "Hey,
right, living out loud on the internet."
Yeah.
So, Dr. Wish, how do you help a patient balance that? You know, they've come to therapy with lots of shame about their history, their childhood story, and then they gain, you know, some peace of mind about it, and, you know, maybe are approaching being okay, that, hey, this is what happens to me, this doesn't define me, and now I want to tell the world, I want to be authentic and honest, and walk up to a stranger or on a first date, start telling their whole story. How do you work with that client?
Well, you first tell them that the pain and the memories are never going to go away. They just get more manageable. It's sort of like looking out at the ocean. Some waves are just little ripples. Some are huge. Some are swells. Some are giant tidal waves. It's called life. And you can decide which kind of waves you want to handle. And you are not inauthentic if you don't tell someone everything about you. In fact, the most important person you should be authentic to is yourself. So you don't owe strangers or people who don't love you your whole story. And even if they do love you, that's the past. You know, you wouldn't go to a party and say, oh, by the way, in 1973, I went on a real bender. No, you wouldn't do that. You just wouldn't do that. So we all are selective as what we want people to know about us, what we believe is important. So I try to undervalue, try to get that stigma down that this is what you have to do in order to be real. No one is real according to those rules. You'd be walking around with a t-shirt that says everything you ever did bad.
Right,
I had five one-night stands in a month. I had, you know, nobody does that. So it's just one more piece of something that you did or had happened to you, and you don't owe anyone every single thing that was not the right road for you to go down. So that doesn't make you less authentic. And I think that word is very powerful because it's sort of out there in the world that you're not real, you're not genuine. Mm-hmm. Well, really? Did you tell someone the
Unless
story?
Unless you're an open book, right? Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. You know, really, that's what you want? Would you want to have, like, every time you meet a person, their brain to light up and a hologram pops up of everything that ever they ever did in their life? You know, I cheated on an exam, I hit someone in the mouth. No, you don't. So you wouldn't do that.
Right.
So why would you have to tell someone about that part of your life?
Yeah.
And so it's getting rid of that victimization identity that has to be addressed.
But sometimes we respond to those questions with, I mean, if we don't want to tell the whole story, and I'm sure that we never do, okay? I never tell the whole story. And I never knew anybody that did. So I'm assuming that there's a narrative construction that takes place in every account of every event.
Yeah.
But you know, a lot of times, if you're depending on who you're asked, right? I mean, if you're in the mode that Dr. Wish is, where someone asked her this question and her immediate response was, "I'd really not interested in telling you much of anything." You know that you instead sometimes people I'll do this. You'll amend the true narrative.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and give a skimpy version of it, or perhaps even an edited, perhaps even a novelized version of it, or turned into a fable of some sort, right? You know, a summary of the experience suitable for the listener.
Correct.
And you know what I mean? And people were very artful about doing that. I'm pretty much convinced now. I think I read this in a Rilke poem not too long ago about how our whole lives are layers of narratives, right? That and stories that circle around some eternal tower that we may never be able to comprehend. But
you're in charge of your. It's called impression management. You're in charge of that. You know, think about your resume, the things you say about yourself. And when you go for a job interview, you would never go to the job interview and say, "By the way, at my previous job, I didn't get along with my boss at all." You wouldn't do that.
Yeah.
Okay? So it's the same model. You don't have to wear everything on your T-shirt, okay? You have to. It's your responsibility to yourself and your happiness and your opportunities in life to take charge of what impression you want to leave. You don't want to tell lies, you know, but you don't owe anyone everything about you.
Right. Yeah, I have two rules of thumb I share with clients is need to know and safety. You know, you reveal things about yourself to someone who's safe to reveal those to someone who
Correct.
Won't re-abuse you or re-shame you, someone who will be
or leave you or throw you off the boat,
right.
Abandon it.
Exactly. Yeah, you know, that's why people go to AA meetings, because they're in a safe space where they can be anonymous
right.
and talk about their struggle, their challenge.
So what happens when attorneys troll AA meetings for customers?
Well, that's inappropriate. You know,
we both know someone who does that.
Yeah, well, that's true.
Awful.
Yeah. It is awful.
Oh my goodness, that's really low.
Yeah,
that's horrible.
Yeah,
no, it's true. Well, yeah, I mean, I had to warn when I recommended the clients attend AA meetings, NA meetings, sex and love addict meetings, or whatever. Of course, it's with the proviso that keep your eyes open. You know, if something doesn't feel comfortable, you know, maybe that's not the meeting for you. You know, there are lots of 12-step meetings out there, and keep searching until you find one that feels like home, like feels like your home group, where there's a lot of recovery in the room and there's welcoming and it feels clean, it feels healthy. Because, yeah, I mean, I've known of some 12-step meetings that were on a Friday night. It was a meat market. It was for people to come to hook up, you know, with other people yeah. for the weekend. You know, they weren't, you know, that was their main agenda. Their main agenda was not coming and sharing from the heart what their struggle of the week was.
So I was talking to someone yesterday who was attending Narcotics Anonymous meetings, okay?
Okay.
He said he liked AA meetings much better, yeah. all right? Even uh-huh. though he was addicted to narcotics.
Gotcha.
And because when he went to the narcotics meetings, everybody wanted to get up and hug everybody, and he wasn't that into that, you know? And
interesting.
Whereas okay. the AA meetings seemed to be a little more... Maybe a little more anonymous. Maybe it's more anonymous than.
That's an interesting twist. What I've never heard that before. What I have heard is that there's more. There seems to be more health and recovery and wisdom in AA meetings. I think because it's an older, you know, yeah. movement. You know, so there are people, you can go to an AA meeting where somebody has absolutely been sober for 30 years and they've worked their steps multiple times and they've acquired a lot of wisdom and empathy mm-hmm. for the newcomers who are in the room. And they know, they've learned boundaries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, learned sure.
That, right. You know, this newbie may be someone who's not only an addict, but recovering from physical trauma, and they don't want to be touched.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
Right. Dr. Wish?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And that goes back to, there are lots of therapies out there, lots of ways to get help. And if you really want to feel good about yourself and productive and not be in pain, find something that works for you, that makes you feel like this person, this group can really help me. There's no one way, just like there's no one pill.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Well, you know, China has a new policy called One Belt, One Road. That they seem to have. I mean,
I didn't hear about this.
No, I mean, when you have a total state control of something. I know we got to get off. Sometimes, you know, you don't have enough diversity in therapies or approaches. Like, there's one answer, you know, and this is the, you know, Dr. Yeah. Spock is the only way to go, you know, ever, and that kind of thing, right?
Well, so. In defense of China, I'm going to push back a little bit because I just came from China.
Yeah, I know.
And what I was amazed was the diversity of faiths there. I mean, there are yeah. all kinds of churches. I mean,
wow.
there's Catholic,
yeah,
there's Protestant,
right.
there's Methodist,
mm-hmm.
there's
the missionaries,
Taoist, there's
them.
Buddhist,
yeah.
you know.
Oh, well, that's the...
And people have a choice, you know, right. people can...
Well, speaking of choice, we got to give Dr. Wish an opportunity to close out here because
Please.
We're coming up on the witch hour here with and
my goodness, it went so fast.
Yeah, I know. Over an hour today rather than an hour and a half, but I don't know. Well, it's a good time for you to summarize, Dr. Wish, and words for the traveling wise, or wise words for the traveling idiots like us.
Not to put you on the spot, but
right, exactly. Have it. Well, you know, you're worth something. I don't care what your past is. I don't care what your fears are, how many times you've fallen off the wagon. You're worth something. And life is really, truly a gift. It's just a gift. And grab it. Seize it. Find who can help you, tough out the toughness of getting better. It's not easy.
All right, pal. Go. That's a great
nice.
Close.
That's
Thank you, Dr.
Close.
Wish, so much. And we'll get the podcast up, I'm guessing, tomorrow because I have to do four of them, and this will be one of them. So,
This is a great one because we talked about addictions and abuse.
Right.
And they often go, you know, together.
Hand in hand. Exactly.
All right. Okay.
Thanks so much, LB.
Thanks
it's
for putting
been a pleasure.
Up, yeah, and thanks for putting up with our new telephone system. I think the audio came out good. Okay, so anyway, take care, pal. Love to talk to you.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And you've been listening to the Are You Crazy Show with Dr. Psyche McGill and John Case and Dr. Leslie Beth Wish. And take care of each other, everybody. It's late. But everything comes next. Yeah.